Okay, I will talk about the state of massive black hole binaries in mergers with large amount of gas. Okay, I'm Andres Scala, and these are my former advisors. Okay, this was part of my PhD thesis. Okay, well, this has two big motivations, this problem. One is one from the astrophysical side. That is like galaxy mergers are common events in the universe, and at least in the local universe, we see that every galaxy with sizable bulge have a massive black hole in the center. Then straightforward question is, what will gonna happen with these two black hole? They will gonna merge, or they will start in the middle. This is an example of the process ongoing. That you are having here a merging galaxy, and you have a binary quasar also in this merging galaxy, this example. And for the side of fundamental physics, this has very important implications. Like the final coalescence of these two black holes will produce a burst that will be observed up to high redshift by LISA if finally it's launched. Okay. I will start reviewing like the standard picture for merger of galaxy with massive black holes in their centers. This was outlined in the 1980s by Beagleman, Blanford, and Rees, and has been proved correct, that is basically correct by numerical simulations like 20 years after. 25 years after this. Basically, you have here a galaxy merger with the black holes at the centers. The black holes are bound to the core nuclei of each galaxy. In the merging process, the nuclei go to the center. And these two nuclei merge with the black holes, forming a newly core, a new core, a newly realized core. Okay? When you have this pair of black holes in this newly formed core, each black hole would suffer dynamical friction or gravitational drag, if you want to call it like that. It's basically like the stars or gas is scattered and focused and forming a current wake, and this wake produces a torque over the orbiting object. This is the classical Chandrasekhar formula for this process, and this formula can be generalized for a gaseous medium. This was done by Ostreicher, Ivo Ostreicher. And the dimensional dependence is the same, but you have a different function that will make we change this problem in factor of two only. Okay, then these two black holes migrate to the center of this newly formed core. When they form a hard binary, they no longer interact efficiently with stars. Each black hole will start. Now it's interact efficiently the binary of black holes with a third star, like three-body problem. This is an example of three-body problem. This is somewhat different. This is for three comparable masses. I take it from Vinay Trimain. And this case is the case of a binary black hole with stars restricted three-body problem, two more, much more massive objects with a third one. But this problem is highly chaotic. And the end product is that you have a third object ejected. Okay. In the case of the restricted, it's always the negligible mass object, the one that is ejected. And this three-body interaction tends to eject star from the galactic nuclei, depleting the phase loss cone. And then could happen that you in some moment you don't have more stars coming close together to interact with the binary, and this binary stall. Like during this like 20 years, there was a lot of, like numerical work, like some numerical work saying that this actually will not happen and you will have some refilling of the lost cone, but this was only a numerical artifact. This is what I'm trying to show here, that this is the work of Makino. There are also the work of people that is here, like David Good. And What happened basically is like the previous simulation that was seen that the binary black hole would finally merge was only a numerical artifact, and if you increase the number of particles in this simulation, you see that the results do not converge. The story can be a little bit different if you have some rotation in the bulge. But for spherical things, this is pretty much what we're going to happen. We're having that the coalescence would stall in, depending on the mass of the black hole, between 0.01 and 1 parsec, where the gravitational radiation is already not an efficient mechanism for merging the binary. Okay. But what all this is missing, like somewhat important story, that this gas, like, in galaxies, especially in these galaxies, you can find a lot of gas, between 1% up to 50% of the mass of the galaxy. And when you merge two galaxies, the gas, basically, that's usually what happened to me with this movie, never mind.
It's only dark matter.
Yeah, so dark, but yeah. But this usually happened to me. Okay, let's do it from outside. The movie is around here. It's in Andes. Okay, it's here. Okay. Okay, this is what happened with the gas. This is basically two Milky Ways. I'm showing the gas in this spiral galaxies. And here you see, like, a merging galaxy, and what's happened here, that most of the gas, these simulations look a little bit crude because I have no smoothing, and here I'm zooming up to the resolution limit of these simulations. And what happened, that actually pretty much in this case 80% of all the mass, gas mass in the original in the galaxies, end up in the central resolution limit. Okay, this is well known, like Ernquist and Barnes. And, well, this second simulation is the type of simulation that I will show in this talk, that is just start with this dense disk in the center and see how we evolve with the binary. Okay? Yes. Okay. What's the next? Okay, detailed studies for different impact parameters of these galaxy mergers found that typically 2/3 of the gas originating in the galaxies end up in this central, very massive nuclear disk. Okay. There are some more recent Barnes 2002 that he really do a big parameter exploration. And Barnes 2002 found between 50% and 90%, depending on these orbital parameters, of the gas will end up in this nuclear disk. And as a rough estimation, you can say that, well, this how compares, like, the mass of the black hole compared to the mass of the bulge is 0.1%, and if you assume that this is like only 1% of the mass in the galaxy is in gas, like the worst case, you find that pretty much you will found 10 times more mass in gas than mass in the black hole. Okay. Okay. Now I will focus on this massive nuclear disk, okay, that are in the center of merging galaxies. From observations, we know that this medium can be characterized by less space, like a clumpy medium, with approximately half of the mass in these clumps, embedded in a less dense, smooth intracloud medium. Okay. Instead of taking a numerical simulation, I see the observation, see the average parameters, and I start a disk that satisfies these average parameters observed. Okay, the typical in this world, the typical mass is 5×10⁹ solar masses of this disk, typical radius of 400 parsecs, disk height of 40 parsecs. The dynamical mass, like the mass in stars, is 5× the mass of the gas. And then I vary the mass ratio between the black holes and the gas. And, well, to model this in detail is highly complex. Okay, you need to treat like a cooling, supernova feedback, and radiation feedback. Okay, and the end product, this is a multi-phase turbulent medium. Okay, this has been done by WADA. And instead of doing that, we simply do some trick, like we use like an adiabatic equation state, and we adjust this adiabatic equation as a free parameter, the parameter k, in order to have the right range of densities that is observed. And with the right range of density, we will have the right torques onto the binary. Okay? And we vary the mass ratio between the black holes between 1 and 1/10. And in previous talk, you will hear about the more extreme mass ratios, like from 1/10 to, I don't know, 1 to the south. Negligible mass. Negligible secondary black hole. Okay. Okay, and this is how it looks, these different models. Here I vary this parameter k in the adiabatic equation state in order to have more clampier types of disk to more smooth ones. Okay. This will be more representative of the clamps in this observing this medium, and this more representative of the intercloud medium. Oh, between a thin factor of 10. Okay. Between 0.4 and 2 something, not a factor of 5. Okay.
So I missed also, what do you use in the adiabatic equation state?
Is it going to be cooling rapidly? No. Yeah, but you have a lot of cooling, but you have a lot of feedback, okay? And this, you arrive to an equilibrium. A dynamical equilibrium, okay?
That's true forming stars?
Yeah. This is No. Reality is forming stars, is ongoing and starburst, okay? And it's highly turbulent, okay? The thickness is not determined by the... This gas is cold, molecular, but it's highly turbulent.
So you replace all that,
in order to have the right densities and have the right torques onto the binary, okay? And also, with adiabatic equation state, you underestimate all the problem. All the wakes that you will have will be less intense than, for example, a 4/3 Povolo, and then you have an upper limit onto the time scales. Okay.
And do you just set up initial conditions with this adiabatic equation state, or do you keep that doing the dynamical evolution?
No. I keep it doing the dynamical evolution.
So it means there's no, for example, if there's shocks or something, there's no entropy.
No. But here you smooth the shocks, okay? And then in reality will be even stronger the shocks and stronger the torques, okay? That's why you are giving an upper limit.
Yeah, but I mean it's a dangerous thing to do, right? Because this pH.
Yeah.
You have an artificial viscosity of some sort.
Yep.
Smooth.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's not consistent then. That's my point. Mm. You need a gamma
line,
right? Gamma. I don't understand how you can do that. Okay, that's right. Then you violate the shock jump condition, so you don't conserve energy and momentum across shocks.
Yeah. I need to take a look on that. Sure. Okay, then what I'm showing here is the distance separation between the binary as a function of time, and for these four different k values, okay? And what I'm showing here is this is the dynamical friction part, okay? And as get closer, like, what is shown here is when dynamical friction is no longer efficient, the two wakes of each black hole are overlapping, okay? And that one, the wake of one it tends to be destroyed by the wake of the other. Then that's why you have this increase in the coalescence time scale.
Yes, just to make it clear, the knockout have stars here, right?
Well, I have it, but I have a disk of a gas embedded in a bulge, okay? And the disk of a gas is denser than the density in the bulge. That's why when you are in the plane, you are dominated by friction from gravitational drag from the gas, okay? But when you turn that off the plane, the binary, it's basically dynamical friction from the stars, okay? That is what I have now, okay? Here I vary the plane inclination angle between the binary and the plane of the disk. And between 0 degrees, 45, 22.5, and 67.5. And what you are seeing here is what I was just explaining, that in this part, for example, 45 degrees, all this part you are orbiting not in the gas of the, not in the disk, you're orbiting the stars, and the stars has a lower density. The profile has lower density, and that's why the dynamical friction is longer here, the time scale longer, and that takes much longer. But as soon as you arrive to the disk, this is took by the gas and goes pretty much faster. Okay. Now I have another parameter, is like the mass ratio between the primary and the secondary. This is the case for equal mass black holes. Okay, 2/3, 1/3, 1/10. Like the three graph looks pretty much the same until approximately here is the time scale that takes the primary black hole to go to the center. Okay, that is the same black hole for the four cases. And here is how much take to the secondary to arrive. Okay, and that changed a lot because you're reducing the mass. And as you recall Chandrasekhar formula, you have less drag onto it. Okay? Okay. Until now, I have only run in the part of dynamical friction, and when dynamical friction start to get inefficient, in order to write to the more interesting part, where when stars, for example, has three-body interaction, this artificial star in my resolution limit, in my gravitational softening, and what I did, I make a resampling to increase resolution, and also reduce my gravitational softening length in order to go further away, and then I continue these simulations and plot it on logarithmic scale. These are the four same things that I was showing it. And the black lines are the low resolution simulations, okay, with larger gravitational softening length, and it starts obviously around the gravitational softening length. And the red lines are the higher resolution ones that I restarted, for example, here. I restart the simulation with a much lower gravitational softening length, okay? In the early evolution of the system, here, all this part, you pretty much has the same behavior, okay? Until you touch a critical point where the physical mechanism that is driving the coalescence changes, okay? In order to illustrate this, I give like four snapshots of this thing, okay? And this, the third one is the critical one, and here is the fourth one. For seeing what is happening with the gas, these are the four snapshots. And we see that in the critical point is when you merge these two spheres. What is these two spheres? Is the gas bound to the, is the gas bound to the binary? Okay, this is pretty much the same as Bondi problem, with Bondi radius, Bondi coil. And when you merge these two bound spheres, you have now a common envelope that has an ellipsoidal form, and this common envelope lags behind the binary, okay? Because this common envelope is losing angular momentum through this spiral wave to the background medium, okay? It's negligible compared, it's like 1% order of magnitude, okay? Then this is important thing, how much is the mass, because this can only act as a catalyst, because if it's this negligible mass ellipsoid gain a considerable fraction of this binary of angular momentum, this will get blown, okay? But this ellipsoid is giving its angular momentum to the rest of the medium, okay? Well, we cannot see. Well, here was an ellipse. Yeah, the point is that in order to check this, we make an analytical model like Lagrangian mechanics of binary with external gravitational potential going behind the binary at a fixed angle, theta. Okay, and we compute how will be the evolution of the binary in this such a case, and with good agreement with the simulation. Okay, we take the density and the angle, the parameter from the simulation, and we check with this model. Okay, then so far this mechanism seems to be efficient in order to reduce the distances down to when gravitational radiation is efficient.
What sets the lag angle is the dissipation in the gas.
It's how you propagate the angular momentum through these wings, okay? Because through these waves. Because otherwise, you will not, if the ellipsoid will don't lose angular momentum against the background gas, this will co-rotate with the binary, okay? But because it's losing this angular momentum, it lags behind.
So I can think about the gas that's bound there, you want to call it some type of spherical atmosphere, right? Or call that spherical atmosphere. It's hot, virialized gas.
Yeah.
Right? It's hot, a hot gas.
Well, this in my simulation is hot gas that tries to emulate cold turbulent gas. Okay. That's basically.
But the external pattern, the spiral pattern, okay, towards the ellipsoid,
yeah,
it's not evolving rapidly. Scale, on the dynamical time scale, on the order of time scale. So that's a fixed torque. So I'm still thinking that this is just like we all know from tidal interactions, tidal spin up at the start. But the lag angles must be fixed by energy dissipation in the gas. If you didn't have any energy dissipation, the lag angle would be zero. Because the forcing is constant. It's just like forcing an oscillator.
Yeah, but that is assuming that you are not like you are seeing that this spiral pattern is fixed, and this is co-rotating with the ellipsoid. Okay.
Well, if you are actually torquing the gas and giving angular momentum to the gas, you can gradually propagate disturbances in the gas, and then they travel out and they are out of phase. The thing that is out of phase is the tide. The
spiral webs can drive angular momentum. That's what this is driving here. Okay. Okay, if you compute the gravitational coalescence timescale, the Peters formula, like, for at the end of our simulations, for a 10 to the 8 solar massive black hole, this is around, we are finishing around when it's starting to be efficient, like it's at least less than a Hubble time. And if you extrapolate one order of magnitude more our simulations, this you arrive to where is comparable the time scale to our time scale. Okay, there is the transition to ellipsoidal torque driven coalescence to gravitational wave-driven coalescence. Okay. Okay. The next question is: how little gas do we need to do this job? Okay. So far, it has been studied like two more extreme cases, like when you have large amount of gas, like in our case, or when you have like an negligible amount of gas, like a binary in an accretion disk, when you always will form and is 2D accretion disk, you will always form a circumbinary gap. This has been well studied in the star formation case, and I think that Milos has been studying this problem too. And what is basically happening, that here the initial tidal torque of the ellipsoid cannot be transported to the rest of the medium, and then this ellipsoid pretty much blow out the medium, forming this gap. Okay. Then we can say that as far as long as you prevent to form this circumbinary gap, you will have an efficient merge of this black holes. But we don't know yet how little gas do we need to prevent this gap. Okay, as I said, I have studied this massive thick disk that has a radius over thickness of the order of 10. And what I have tried to argue is that these things are widely present in merging galaxies, and in principle, in starboard galaxies, this black hole will emerge. And the other strange case that has been studied is a two-dimensional accretion disk. They have negligible mass. There are only valid solutions for separations less than 1,000 Schwarzschild radii. Beyond that separation, you will have gravity important, and this will or either form stars and fragment, or either be heated and get thicker due to self gravity. Then we need new simulation in order to determine well under which condition you will have this gap opening criteria. And as a summary, gravitational interaction with the gaseous medium is able to reduce binary separation down to where gravitational radiation is efficient. So far, we don't see any signature, at least in the gas-rich case, of coalescence-stalling. And for that reason, we think that gas-rich merging galaxies, Ullrich, Lyrs, are good candidates for LISA events. Okay, thank you. Question?
Well, maybe this is at the danger of of boring people. Could you please go back to the gravitational radiation formula, the TGR?
Okay.
So they're making always the same point. Because if you look at the F of D, that's actually a very strong dependence on the eccentricity, which can balance the force power of A over 0.01 R centimeters. If you have just
I'm a much more eccentric orbit. Yeah, I just focus in on the worst case.
So if you have 0.9 eccentricity, basically you can balance the A over 0.01 power factor to get the same signal with a 10 times further semi-major
excess. Yeah, I take in.
It's just always interesting to note. And the second question would be then, I mean, whether you can say something about the influence of dynamical friction in your case to the orbit? I mean, does it circularize strictly in your case? Or
well, I start with circular orbits. I study the worst case, the circular orbit, where this is one, basically. But the studies on the same model of other people found that when you have a when you are co-rotating with the disk, you tend to circularize the orbits. But when you are counting rotating, you pretty much don't affect the initial orbits.
So, do you ever see eccentricity growing? Because there were claims previously in the literature that coupling an orbit to gas outside would actually be
No. Actually, I have not. I have only.
You see.
Yeah. Other people like have used the same model as I use, and what I was answering to him, and they found that when you are co-rotating with the gas, you tend to circularize the orbit. They start with highly eccentric and tend to circularize, but when you are counter-rotating the orbit, you pretty much don't affect the eccentricity of the orbit. It's four-thirds. So they use.
No, but how important? I mean, because Antikis finds that if the gas doesn't cool efficiently, the angular friction stores at about kiloparsecs
Kelvin. Well, what they found is they make a galaxy merger with an adiabatic equation state, but it's completely different. If you merge that, you don't form this gaseous dense disk. That's
but
what they found. Yeah, but it's basically assumed that during the merger, like all merger simulation, they pretty much assume isothermal equation state. Like they use cooling, but the cooling time scales up to 10 to the 4 Kelvin are pretty much shorter to any other time scale. And then during the merger, they assume that it's pretty much isothermal, okay? And they cut the cooling function at 10 to the 4 Kelvin in order to prevent sub-fragmentation. because they are using isothermal question of state, and if you have unstable clamps, you will form runaway clamps. Okay, they do tricks. Okay. Yeah, but as far as I remember, they make a galaxy simulation with adiabatic equation of state, and that make you.
The question is, can you comment on how much different equation of states change?
Yeah, well, as this is the worst case, it's adiabatic. Any wake that you form, it will be smoother than in an isothermal or in a fourth thirds, okay? And then the torque will be less than in that case, okay? In that sense, this is the worst case, possible case, okay? And there are, supposedly, for a starburst galaxy, the best equation of state is 4/3. Okay? And that means that will be a little bit faster than this thing.
But even worse would be to have lost a lot of the gas mass by converting it to stars before it gets to the region of interest.
Well, you mean in the galaxy merger or in this
somewhere
part? Okay. There's two things. These things, if you calculate the total time signal, are typically 10 to the 7 years. And the lifetime of this massive nuclear disk are typically 10 to the 8 years. Okay, then you will have.
Based on what? Based on observation?
Observation. Okay. Yeah. Because there are not.
Observations are not of systems that have just done that.
So, they are.
Yeah.
They are?
Without the elements.
Yeah. The nuclear disk? Yeah.
So, these are merging. These are this emerging
galaxy. Yeah. Emerging galaxy Jewelers, you found this huge disk in the center.
Yeah.
And it's in agreement with Barnes and Enquist, whatever.
Is nuclear disk somehow
100 parsec? This tens of parsec, well, within a kiloparsec, okay, diameter.
By the way, it can go to 0.1 parsec.
Well, you think you are thinking in a ring?
Whether they have some ring or some.
Well, that depends. It's not clear if you have like the detailed simulation of this, like WADA, they don't found any ring, because the inner limbal resonant will make a ring, but you have a lot of cell gravity that produces this turbulent viscosity that fill off this. Okay. The attempt to model this realistic found something like this. And all the turbulence, any possible disk is filled, a ring hole is filled by this turbulence.
So you don't think about the star formation in your nuclear disk?
No. In my, I'm neglecting that, but I'm comparing with the overall lifetime of the gas. Okay. Like in 10 to the 8 years, supposedly this will not be any gas left. Okay. But all this process happens in 1/10 of that, pretty much.
For each black hole to have a hot atmosphere, there probably has to be a source of heating inside or very close to the black holes. The idea that there can be starbursting turbulent medium implies that there are actually stars in the gas.
And you are consuming this gas, but you are consuming in a time frame longer than all this process. And where you can neglect the star formation is only within a 1,000 Schwarzschild radius. Because that the gravity completely dominates by the central black holes. Okay, but beyond that, you can well assume that you will form stars. You have all this heat, all this turbulence.
Do you have a sense of which galaxies this is not applicable to in terms of morphology or size or anything?
Well, this, if you merge two these elliptical galaxies with no gas at all, you will have like your type of simulation for sure.
And in between, you can give any sense to, I don't know, characteristic luminosity at which this condition, or does anyone know enough about the gas fraction?
Well, I mentioned the gas fraction in these galaxies, and I compute that for the worst case, well, order of magnitude, you will have 10 times more mass in gas, that will be sort of okay. Then you need to do realistic simulations in order to see if you will form a gap or not in that case. Okay, but this is estimating from SA galaxies, like 1% of the mass in gas, and you throw all that gas in the center. But this is 0.1% the mass of the black hole compared to the mass of the galaxy. and that just gives you your de facto thing. Okay. Ah, sorry. Is it for the broadcasting?
I'm a bit nervous here because my laptop tried to commit suicide last week and didn't succeed. But it's a little flaky. Okay, so first I want to say thanks very much for... Oops! You're not supposed to be able to see this. Does anyone know how to fix this?
Try to change the display with how they are mirroring.
Turn mirroring off.
In displays?
Yeah.
You have to first quit here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you get to see my cheat sheet.
Yeah,
also my little they're actually written reasonably okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh great. Okay, so I first want to say thank you very much for inviting me. It's the first time that I've been here and I was a little nervous because part of the program involved people who are not my people. Like, you know, you're not people I would see in conferences I normally go to, right? But it's been wonderful, it's been really enjoyable. I'm here for another week, so please feel free to come by and chat. So what I want to give is a very brief synopsis of some interesting results from simple modeling that was inspired by work that, and most of this work has been done with Phil Armitage, actually all of the three papers, and they're all with Phil. And he is the numerical half of the collaboration. So if you ask me very technical questions, I have my cheat sheets, but... it was inspired by the fact that he works on formation of planets and protoplanetary disks and evolution of embedded planets and planetesimals and protoplanetary disks. And it became very clear that it's roughly the same problem if you consider a primary black hole and a secondary black hole if you start with coplanar configuration. So that's what prompted us to do this. And the other thing was sort of an increasing frustration with my cosmology colleagues where everyone assumed that, you know, mergers are instantaneous. So we really wanted to know, okay, what is going to determine a rough time scale? And is there any redshift at which the inferred time is going to become an issue? So that's something we wanted to look at. So as you all know, there's the sort of the usual last parsec problem, where, so for example, if you have a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole primary and a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, gravitational wave-driven merger will occur within a Hubble time if they start out, if they end up, if you start off with a separation of 0.01 parsec, then yes, you can make it happen. But the question is, how do you bring them that close to start with? And so, of course, the usual problem is how do you get rid of all this angular momentum in the binary, and you want to do it in the center of the galactic nucleus, so you have three choices. You have the dark matter that you could somehow transfer to, or stars, or gas. And it seemed quite compelling because there's a lot of gas in galactic nuclei, so we thought, okay, let's look at a very simple case and see what happens and if we can get an estimate of the time scale that it would take. And if there are any interesting properties, it's obvious that if you embed them in the disk, it's going to depend on the properties of the disk and the viscosity of the disk. So we were interested in seeing, you know, what are the key properties. So the gas offers, as I'll argue, a very efficient sink for the angular momentum. And for mass ratios, much less than one. So I have not looked at the equal mass ratio case at all. Okay, so it's a very restricted parameter space. As I said, you know, it's for a very special but interesting case, I think. And so what you have is the interaction of a low mass secondary but the disk mass is comparable to the mass of the secondary. Okay, so that's the condition under which a lot of what I'm going to show you sort of works. Okay. So don't really need to, and of course I'm ignoring black hole spin because, you know, not in the relativistic regime. Still very much, I mean, our calculations pretty much stop where, even for the eccentricity stuff in the weak field limit, we are still very much in the weak field limit for anything that we are trying to do. So the thing is, I don't really have to make a strong case to all of you, but basically there's a lot of gas. And the interesting thing is there are some consequences of having gas-driven binary black hole mergers. And there are two sorts of interesting consequences, observationally speaking. One is that there can be a particular gravitational wave signature because you could end up with finite eccentricity at the merger. So that's going to be the second half. I'll just show you a few slides with the results. And I'm going to primarily start off with the existence of electromagnetic counterparts to supermassive black hole mergers. So it would be very convenient for LISA if we could find electromagnetic counterparts that signal where this is happening. So the question, of course, is that there are a lot of people here, including people here, who worked on using stellar dynamics to affect these closed separations, right, before gravitational wave dominated in spiral takes over. The question is, if the gas is implicated, what's the evidence, and can we distinguish those two cases? That's sort of what we set out to do.
Can I ask about the first point?
Sure.
I guess you'll say more that in one sense that a signature of the gas, because in every stellar merger, it's walking up very high, because the gas is reducing eccentricity.
Well, I guess there's a characteristic. The argument there is that, yes, I mean, I was under the impression that for the stellar dynamical case, it was not resolved because our set finds something quite different from us, right? So I, you know, what we thought was something, is there a clean signature for the gas? I'm not necessarily arguing that that's, you know, going to be sort of a smoking gun, okay? Okay. So the angular momentum losses to this stellar component are quite efficient at large radius, right? But it slows down at parsec scale, as you know, all know, this lost cone, and both Milos and David have worked on it. So Milos, both our names are so complicated that we just get the initials. I'm PN and you're MM, basically. So, so they've done a lot of work and they've shown that, you know, this can work. And this is just a figure from, I think it's their 2001 or 2002 paper, where I think you use Gadget, right? This was when you use Gadget and you...
The actual smooth curve is the N-body 6.
Oh, I see. Oh, it's that's yours. Oh, I see. And I think the squares are Gadget. Squares are Gadget. Right. So that's the separation and that's the stellar density row, right? So basically the argument is that, yes, there are stellar dynamical processes that can do the job. I mean, so this is something that's really actively worked on. But the point is, observationally, we know that AGN have disks, and there is gas around. So anyway, I don't have to belabor this. I mean, the question is that there is gas. It coexists with the binary in the nucleus. So why not see what the effect of the gas might be? Oops. Oh, yeah. I'm just so nervous handling this computer right now that... I don't know what's happened to my computer. Okay. So basically what we've done is we've set up a disk, an isothermal disk with some alpha prescription, drop the secondary on, let it evolve, and see. So as you expect spiral density waves to be excited, the circumbinary disk, and because of the criterion that the mass in the disk is comparable to the mass of the secondary within the radius where we drop it, you open up a gap. So you open up a gap and this evolves. This is very familiar to a lot of you here who work on planets. So then, and as I said, one of the reasons this sequence works rather well only when you have quite a lot of gas mass, right? And that's the case that we have done. So there's a lot of gas and it's quite easy with a simple alpha. So basically what you want is you need a viscosity prescription for the gas to make sure that you can effectively lose angular momentum and drive mass in. And the simple alpha prescription is, we found it adequate and interesting to do. So what you find, and I'll show you the results in just a minute. So what you actually find when you start off with those initial conditions is that there are two phases to the evolution of the binary. In the first phase, it's the disk-driven phase. So the viscosity of the disk, the torque from the viscosity of the disk drives the secondary in towards the center and angular momentum out. And then at some point, you reach a separation where losses in spiral due to loss of gravitational variation takes over. So the question is, you only have to reach that far with the gas. You need the gas to do the job up to that point, right? And so I'll show you. So basically, the disk-driven migration rate is just proportional to h over r squared, which is disk thickness over r squared, and alpha, and the Keplerian velocity. Just to give you an idea, that's where the disk properties really feed in. So you can look at hot disk, cold disk, you know, colder disks, and so on. And nu, so the alpha prescription is the standard one. Nu is alpha CSH.
Are they not some gravitational?
These disks? No. So the gravitational wave losses after you reach a particular separation, I'll just give you some numbers, this particular value, so you get a sense. The gravitational wave losses are just proportional to mass of the primary times mass of the secondary times the product of the sum of the masses, roughly. And it goes as 1 over separation cube, which is why it's so fast. It really moves in very fast. So what we can do is calculate, as I said, by calculating the viscous-driven rate, equating that to the gravitational wave rate, we can come up with a critical separation that depends on disk properties, quite crucially, as well as the mass ratio, which is Q. Right? So for example, if we take H over R and alpha 0.01, and we took the primary mass, I think for the results I'm going to show you, it's 5 times 10 to the 8 solar masses, and the secondary is 10 to the 7 solar masses. So that's our mass ratio. Our mass ratios define the opposite way to some people. The critical, a critical for that particular set of values is about 100 times the gravitational radius of the primary. So it's 100 GM1 over C squared. And once you are inside this critical radius, the disk is basically inconsequential, other than the fact that it's a gas reservoir, right? Because the disk torques are not that effective once you're inside this critical radius. And basically, you just in-spiral very rapidly, as I said, because the gravitational wave-driven in-spiral goes as 1 over 8 cubed, so it's very swift. So the interesting thing is that there are some very nice signatures. You know, you still maintain the gap, even though you are driven by gravitation wave in-spiral. And the torques still continue to extract angular momentum from the disk. But let's show some... I'll just show you some plots in the web. The probable consequences are, as I'll focus a little later on, what could be a signature in the eccentricity. And of course, there could be signatures in the spin. This is sort of work that we are doing right now, and I really don't have any new results to show you quite yet. So I want to show a movie that Phil made of this, which is the disk response to the perturber. Perturber is a secondary black hole. Right? So it goes very slowly, as in you'll see the waves slowly built up. And it's pretty much in a steady state, doesn't fragment, right? So this is a 2D hydro-only simulation. This was done with Zeus. And viscosity is included so that alpha is roughly 0.01 in the vicinity of the secondary. And in the inset, the movie has an inset where I show the average surface density, the disk surface density profile, I think. It's happening, actually, believe me. It picks up slowly. So you can see the secondary, the position of the primary, and you can see the spiral density waves being set up.
Secondary is growing in mass.
Yes, it is growing in mass. So the accretion, so interesting thing, I'll show you the accretion rates, et cetera, in a following plot. So the accretion rate onto the primary is actually suppressed during this phase, and the accretion rate onto the primary, on the secondary, of course, goes up.
Right. But there's gas between the secondary and the primary.
Yes.
So then the accretion rate onto the primary should be enhanced.
It's not quite, just because of the angular momentum, right? That the amount of angular momentum once you have a bound binary that you have to lose for the same accretion rate is larger, so it's suppressed. I'll just show you. Well, this is for 5 times 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 7, roughly 1/10. Okay, so these are the sort of to, oh gosh, this green really sucks. Okay, so these are the two phases. This is the disk-driven, is this the laser pointer? So this is the disk-driven migration state, and what you see here is the gap. So these are three different snapshots for the parameter values that I just mentioned. So here you see the gap, okay? So this is the inner part of the disk, surface density of the disk, and you see this gap. The gap moves in as time goes on, so you see these dashed lines. There are actually so three times snapshots here. And what you see here is what happens roughly in the gravitation radiation driven in spiral stage. As I told you earlier, the gap is still maintained, right? And there may be some small flow across the gap, which you know we've not calculated at this point.
Okay, this yeah. is not from the Zeus, it's from the 1D.
It's from a 1D, yes. The Zeus was used to calibrate one of our parameters that fixes the magnitude of the torque that we really need so that at the critical radius, and the radius that we go into the A dot is roughly a fraction of the Keplerian velocity. So this use was used just for calibration, absolutely right. So what you see here is in the gravitational radiation driven in spiral stage, you see that there's some mass that piles up here in the center, okay? And that's important because of the claim that I'm going to make about observational consequences, you know, when you're accreting. So in this stage, the secondary is also accreting, and the accretion rate onto the primary is slightly suppressed, if you see it's slightly suppressed, surface mass density there. Not by a huge amount, just an order of magnitude or so. Whereas, well, you know, we use slightly different scales and different levels of precision or imprecision. Whereas here you find that there's a lot of mass that's piled up here, so you should be able to see at this stage very, very high accretion rates. That's what I will claim, that you see very high accretion rates, probably enormous outflows, and so on and so forth. So this is just to show you that, doesn't work just for that particular choice of parameters, right? But it is more inefficient if you look at other mass ratios. Okay, so this is the migration in disk with the same viscosity, but lower disk masses. As I told you, this is the most massive disk happens. Merger occurs at around few times 10 to the 7 years. And remember, this is basically the time scale is dominated by the time it takes for the disk dominated in spiral. Okay, the gravitational wave stage, right? That's 10 to the 5 years or something. It's nothing. It's peanuts. Once you get it in there. So this is really just a disk-driven stage. So what you find is for the most massive disk, it's very successful, a few times 10 to the 7 years. And the less mass there is in this, so this is a tenth and a hundredth less mass in the disk, it's not as efficient. Okay, so.
But is it still like from the green line, is it still happening?
Yes, it'll still it'll probably be Hubble time. It's not there. Okay, really, I'm going to go back. I think there's so I guess one of the implications is that the binaries would be, sorry, did I try to blind you? Binaries could be embedded in lower mass disks, right? So just what Vicky asked, they could be sort of sitting around doing nothing. So if you do a flux limited survey, AGN, you're less likely to pick up those kinds of guys, right? Because they're just sitting there, and there's going to be some accretion onto the primary, not a whole lot of accretion onto the secondary, well, not to be picked up as double nuclei anyway. They'll be lingering for too long, okay? So you would traditionally not, and there'll be a reduced level of accretion for those in that case, because it's just spread over longer time scales. And you will find, we tried to speculate that those could be the low luminosity galactic nuclei. But, you know, this would mean that all the low luminosity galactic nuclei that are not claiming that every low luminosity galactic nucleus that we're seeing is actually a hung binary, okay, embedded in gas. I'm not quite saying that, but these could be those kinds of systems. Right. My sense is very, very efficient, right? Of the primary. So it's a very, very massive disk. Well, and a secondary. It'll be his kind of simulation, right? But not. It may go unstable. Yeah, I don't know. I guess then the first of all, the thin disk will not work at that point as well. I mean, at least the evolution of the motion of the secondary, you're keeping that approximation valid. No, it breaks down even for what I do towards the end, right? It's no longer a thin disk, it'll be some fat thing in the middle. But no, I've not thought about that case. I just assumed that that would be more like his very massive gas.
There should be something between.
Well, I think the in-between cases are clearly going to be the case where it's self-gravitating and you have to worry about fragmentation as well. It's complicated.
So these cases are gravitational stable?
Yes.
Yeah. So I got the impression from the previous talk that from observations we know that there's a lot of gas.
ULERGs are not all galaxies though. Right, I mean, the ultra-luminous infrared galaxies are a class of galaxies. So
which class is
it? No, I mean, this is a generic case. I mean, I would argue that this is a more general case and not, you know, requiring a very, very high. I'm only requiring the tuning that, you know, the mass is comparable to that of the secondary. And I would argue that this applies to a larger class of galaxies than the ULERG case. But, you know, and there are people who work in galaxy formation who would say that, you know, every merger goes through a ULERG phase, and then it fades. But, you know, not every, depending on whether you merge an elliptical, you know, if you start out with two gas-rich entities, that's fine. But if you start out with one elliptical and one spiral or two very dry ellipticals, then it's different, right? So. Right. But, you know, minor mergers, I think Martha would agree, are more frequent and more the average behavior in the universe. So if you look at the galaxy like the Milky Way, like 10 to the 12 solar masses today, if you look at the average number of major mergers it's had, it's 1. Whereas the number of minor mergers it's had is about 10, going back to, say, redshift 10 or so. Right? Of course, you keep going back in redshift and you can build these numbers. But the major mergers are quite rare.
So for these more common cases, observationally, what do we know about the ratio of the gas mass?
No, not very well determined in the inner regions. Yeah, it's quite hard. There are a few cases where people have seen disks and they have estimates. But as I would argue that one, you know, sort of couple of steps downstream, one of the things we predict is that you should have very, very strong outflows. And I could argue that that is what is seen in broad absorption. Line quasar. That kind of outflow is what we think is a very strong prediction or something like this. But whether the separations are going to be really, really small by the time you see that stage. So you're not going to be detecting two nuclei by then, right? So this is still all speculation, but guarded.
In the regime that you looked at, if the primary is then the sixth and the seventh, the thing that's coming in is really satellite.
Yeah, 10 to the 4 solar masses.
And these typically make it all the way to actually get this started?
Well, that's another issue that I have not looked at, right? I'm assuming they're coplanar to start with. I have not worried about whether every little thing like that will be captured and how long it would take before it actually gets coplanar. That has been a criticism of what we did, but you know, it's a...
And then there are the reasons for assuming they coplanarity, because in the group setup,
case, yes. It's not entirely clear, but the fact that there is gas and diskiness is inevitable.
In what sense? Because you're including there are galaxies which are going to be formed so that it must be called.
No, but I'm
not generic in the generic.
Not generic in the but as I said, you know, I am still talking about supermassive black holes. I'm really talking about.
Okay, this is just a.
Yeah.
So what you're really talking is it's a qubit called 10 or 1/10.
Yeah, 10th. 10th to 100.
The other thing is for research.
Yeah, yeah.
I have another question.
Sure.
How do we avoid actually that you get
don't get sometimes out of migration with the object. I don't know exactly what are the conditions, but.
Well, it's isothermal, and well, why don't we get outward migration?
In planetary systems, you can use this to get planets migrate outwards also. I think, for example, if you start having more gas inside, you can the incoming object outside, that would be probably
what. Well, actually, in general, you get more. Sure. They go very different direction than we get from inside. And you need very special conditions
to do it outward.
Yeah, but generally, I don't know what these conditions are.
Do you think it has to do with whether there's angular momentum in the secondary?
You need something like there's a mass ratio range where you get like free vibration. I think you're not.
I'm not in that regime, no. Yeah.
The question.
But I don't know what that mass, honestly, I don't know what that mass ratio is.
It's like you have some minus 4.
Okay, so it's very extreme. Okay. So of course, this suppression in the accretion rate, you know, all of that I just argued for, right? You might have noticed, right? It's only for cold gas, right? If the gas is hot, I'm giving you all the caveats here, right? If the gas is hot, and with low specific angular momentum.
So hot gas is at middle temperature. Cold is H over R.
Mod one, yeah. Yeah, H over R here was 0.01, roughly. Right? Suppressed to what it would be if it was a single black hole with that repository of gas, without the secondary planted in the disk. Okay, so here, so I just drew this cartoon because I think Milo should probably be talking at some point about just slightly different in terms of the in terms of whether the gas exists till the end. I mean, in his case, the gas is evacuated from the center, right? The case that you and Stirl calculated. So this is just to show you a cartoon, because I'm sure you'll hear at some point his cartoon is going to be different from ours, right? So what we think the ultimate fate of this system is going to be, you know, you'll have this inner disk, which is now detached because of the gap from the rest of the from the outer disk, right? The time scales are totally different for the outer disk. They're very long, so it doesn't matter. The inner disk, all the material that's in the inner disk has nowhere to go but be accreted. Therefore, there'll be extremely high accretion rate at the end when the merger actually happens. But of course, at that point, our thin disk approximation breaks down. So we really can't calculate. I can only calculate an effective accretion rate to 10 to the 6 solar masses per year or so for the configuration that I talked about a little while ago, a 5 times 10 to the 8 solar mass primary and the 10 to the 7 solar mass secondary. So we think that the end state in terms of electromagnetic counterparts would be something that has extremely high accretion rates, probably some kind of final common envelope evolution with very, very strong outflows and so on and so forth. So the...
What would be the time scale?
It would probably be a flare. I mean, it will be a burst.
A million
to 10 million years, roughly.
Yes.
For
that.
Not quite. That's why we said, okay, this is not good enough. Let's see if eccentricity will go. Yeah. So depending on the parameters that you choose, that determines how much gas you have left in the center, and the accretion rate, as I said, very, very high, and you could see this sort of X-rays, possibly, and very strong outflows for between million to 10 million years. And we actually didn't calculate, you know, a spectrum for that or anything like that. We just said, okay, this is sort of roughly what it should look like. So the idea here is that if a thin disk is implicated, you know, to affect the disk-driven migration in the early stages, you predict something that would be like a highly obscured luminous quasar, because you'll have these outflows. And I can tune the parameters if I want to match the Hopkins et al. Duration of the obscured phase. Okay.
So the detection would be the error box of Visa and see how many obscured quasars there are, and see if one of them.
Right. Yeah. Conversely, I would argue
there's one.
More conservatively, one of them. Okay, so.
Yeah, on this last one, I understand highly obscured. I'm not sure why do you think it will be luminous?
Because well, because the gas will be accreted. the obscuration is going to come from the outflow.
From the outflow.
Right.
But didn't you say that you expect the suppression of the accretion
waves? Oh, no, that's while the migration is happening. This is after the final merger, right. I mean, that statement was for the disk-driven migration stage, before final coalescence.
In this GR-driven migration phase, don't you expect a lot of gas to be escaping back across the gap from the inner disk onto the outer disk?
We did a very simple
description, the torque density exerted by the secondary black hole diverges, so by definition they cannot be escaped. But that's an approximation.
So as I said, there will be some flow across the gap, and we estimated it to be small. Okay. So the question is, so this is the rough storyline for the electromagnetic counterparts, right? So as I just mentioned, there are people who've said they're going to be precursors, like us, and there are people who've said they'll be afterglows, right? Precursors and afterglows in terms of electromagnetic counterparts. So on longer timescales, they're obviously, when the final merger happens, there'll be an impulsive change to the final black hole spin, and Scott has calculated that. And then there's some other predictions, like the changes in the directions of jets that are launched, and I think David has worked on that. And so we thought, okay, what is the final eccentricity before the merger? Let's see if there's any signal there. And that was really inspired by a paper that Barak and Cutler wrote, where they said LISA could measure eccentricities to 10⁻⁴. And we're like, oh, okay, that's, well, you know, I don't know how realistic or whatever it is, but we started off because it seemed like that may be an interesting quantity to focus on. So the question is whether final eccentricity before the merger can signal the fact that disks are catalyzing this merger. So we thought, let's just take a look at that. And before I move on to that, there's a very nice recent paper by Dotti and company, where they argue that the mass ratio and the mass of the primary determines, with the same sorts of arguments that I've done, that I've sort of outlined for you, and using the two regimes that Milos has worked on, we've worked on, argue that, you know, in their case you would see the afterglows, and in our case we would see all these precursors. So we can ignore the other things in this plot, because they argue that, you know, when the primary is very, very massive, you could also possibly see sort of tidal disruption of stars that approach it, and so on. And then they also argue that that you will always trigger a starburst when you have a merger. That's sort of in line with what people in cosmology are doing. So in this case, I just want to point out, the reason there's an afterglow is that, and there's no precursor for that picture, is that the gas is consumed long before the merger. So the afterglow in X-rays is expected when the gas refills. Right. That's a correct representation of your model? Okay, so the question was, okay, what happens to the eccentricity of the binary? And once again, we were inspired by calculations that people did for the planetary case, as well as pre-main sequence stars, what's really happening to the eccentricity, pre-main sequence binaries, when they form. So the interesting thing is that the disk torques are actually negligible during the final inspiral. So what we know is, if we are in the weak field limit, once you've reached a stage where your gravitational wave-dominated inspiral, there are actually, in the weak field limit, equations that you can simply integrate for dEdt and dJdt, and you find that the eccentricity actually damps, okay, in that stage. But in the disk-driven stage, you can grow the eccentricity. So it's a competition between how much you can grow it, for how long you are disk-dominated, versus how quickly you reach this critical radius after which your eccentricity can damp. So that's why this was interesting to actually do a few cases to see what we find. So this is just a toy calculation, so let me show you some nicer plots. So here the eccentricity, right, is excited by the interaction between the binary and the gas disk, and it's only partially damped during the final phase, but you can calculate it, okay? So, and the eccentricity, therefore, say 1 week before the merger or 1 year before the merger, can be non-zero. So that's what we wanted to show, that there are cases, very reasonable cases, which fit in with our disk-driven migration scenario, that would give you that signal, right? So Artimowitz, Goldreich and Sari and Papalazu have calculated and done analytic work, which we used. They were not easy papers to read on the gravitational interaction with the disk, you know, massive disk and an embedded planet. That's the case that Goldreich and Sari had done. So what you see here are, in the disk-driven stage, two interesting things are happening. So as I just argued and told you, that the separation, A, the binary shrinking, right, and this, these three different lines are for three different values of H over R, so the, sort of a going from a cold disk to an intermediate warm disk to a very hot disk. What you find, as you can see right away, that the binary shrinks most efficiently in the cold disk, in the hot disk, right? That's the separation. And that's the eccentricity growth. And you see that they don't happen most efficiently in the same kind of disk. And therefore, it's interesting to calculate what really happens. Once you are in the disk-dominated stage, you start off with some tiny eccentricity, see how far you can grow it to as a function of disk parameters, right? And then the gravitational wave in spiral damping takes over, with the initial eccentricity now being the final value that you get from the disk-driven migration stage. And then you see how far you can damp it. So that's really what we've done for a bunch of models. And to be, yeah, and I should also say here, this was 2D, and you know, the viscosity, we had to do a tricky prescription because, in fact, the turbulence, MRI-driven turbulence, that's the source of viscosity in sort of these regimes and for this particular mechanism. But you know, doing that numerically is impossible. So we fudged and we did something where we mimicked a kinematic viscosity, basically, and that's a prescription that Papalozu and his team have worked on for a couple of years. So we just used that prescription. So because, yep.
How far apart are the two objects by the end of this?
Oh, by the end of this, they are, you mean the separation, where do you actually reach it? 10 to the minus 4 parsec or so for the numbers that I gave you. Pardon? The. Yeah. Yes, and that's what I told you, and we're, you know, it's under the assumption that, so we don't get the, we put in a fake prescription for the viscosity, kinematic viscosity. Okay. So what you, what we assume that basically the kinematic viscosity operates only in the azimuthal component. Okay. So this is like type 2 migration of planets, right? This, so it's the same disk story. Now the inner truncation radius of the gap depend on the mass ratio disk parameters, and now the initial eccentricity that you start out with as well. Right? Starting out. So for small eccentricities, you find that there's a truncation of the inner radius at twice the separation, roughly. So what ends up happening here is you have a circumbinary region that detaches, right? And there are also individual accretion disks around the two sources, the primary and the secondary. Okay. And the question is, okay, why does the eccentricity grow in this disk-driven phase? I mean, I think the only way I can sort of try to explain it is basically it's driven by resonant interactions that you have, which are large-scale, long-range. So they have to do, so the Lindwall resonance, the relevant one, is the 1:3 outer one, and that occurs around R equals 2.08a or something, quite close to where this truncation happens. So what is really happening is that the eccentricity is growing because of coupling to the resonances. I can't come up with a nice way to explain. It's quite difficult. You can see it in the movie. It may help a little bit. So this shows what is happening to the growth of the eccentricity as a function of separation. So remember, your separation is shrinking, right, when you're in this disk as well, but your eccentricity is growing. And that's a model that Artimowitz and collaborators calculated. So we try to match and reproduce their results, which is sort of that slope, and we get something slightly different. The conditions were slightly different as well, anyway. But what we find is that the eccentricity does grow, right? And that it grows much more effectively for the cold disk than it does for the hot disk. So what is shown here is the final damping. So this value, the starting point there, is determined by the value that I end up, the final value that I get after the disk-driven stage. So this is the gravitational wave-driven stage where the eccentricity actually damps. So what you see is the eccentricity a year before merger and a week before merger. So it damps, but not completely. So the point here is that this is not actually going to zero. So you see a finite eccentricity here. And I just want to point out that, you know, we estimated some lower limits on what the eccentricity should be. So this band gives you sort of the lower limit that it should be. So the argument is that if LISA can actually measure an eccentricity of 1% or so, which they claim that they will, then that may signal the fact that you've had a gas-driven stage followed by gravitational inspiral. But David's point is well taken that, you know, what happens in the stellar dynamical case may not be that clean to distinguish. But at the moment, they are not settled on what's really happening. Well, I don't know, what do you think of our claim? Do you buy his claim?
It was just a very small set of integrations and a small n as well. I have some published figures to show that as you increase n,
you know, oh, so it's just small, okay.
What do you mean by our claim?
The whether stellar dynamical processes will always give you growth or damping of the eccentricity.
Well, I remember only one simulation of him, I think, so it reached very high eccentricity. Then you see the gravitational radiation. Maybe that's something new, I don't know.
Well, how recent is this?
It's 2003 or 2004 or something. I would tend to think you can distinguish the gas dynamical processes by having very low eccentricity.
Relative, right. Well, but you know, once we settle whether the stellar dynamical processes are giving you preferentially an eccentricity distribution that's skewed to higher values, then yes. But I mean, I think potentially this is a signal.
But actually, I mean, there are, I mean, not to say it's all clear, I mean, there are some, David has some simulation where the eccentricity is really low. And,
right. So
I tend usually to advocate that you get very high eccentricities. Okay. This valley, actually.
Okay.
And they could
be so you're one of the.
You know,
okay.
If you start an open line up there, and even David has recent simulations with triple records where you go to 0.99 and then you end up here maybe at
0.1 or 0.2
something like that. Something that is interesting. I mean, definitely.
Your initial value of 0.1, is this something like a signal value you expect from the gas?
Yes, from the gas. So, let's see if there's anything. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to. Well, the other thing is that there's a calculation that in a strong field limit, like during the plunge, the eccentricity increases again. So, you know, and I don't know enough to judge how good the weather means. Okay.
Yeah.
At that point, okay. So I didn't want to go there.
It's also a tiny region.
And I was going to say it's the really tiny region where
it
happens.
It's right where the calculations that show it, the approximations break down. They might be doing it or not, but anyway, since time.
Okay, so this is just a cute little movie, but to show you that it's the same sort of general behavior, the disk-driven migration, but we're starting with a modestly eccentric orbit. Point one, I think. Let me check if I have that number, actually. I don't have it in my cheat sheet on the Mac. I must have it with me. Yeah, point one. The initial eccentricity. So this is just to show you that, you know, that nothing is fundamentally different in terms of the density wave. That's what is crucial in terms of transferring angular momentum and for all the accretion rate arguments, etc.
Okay, so I will stop here. Any further questions?